Welcome to The Man for Texas, Episode 3, The Impossible Peace. I'm Brandon Seal. A European visitor to Mexico City in the early 19th century described it as the City of Palaces, a nod both to its role as the old Aztec capital, but also to its spectacular concentration of wealth. One-third of the wealth of all of New Spain, known formally after 1822 as Mexico, was concentrated in this great cosmopolitan city. Then, as now, the exact limits of Mexico City were a bit fuzzy, but something like 1 million people, a fifth of the new country, considered Mexico City the base of their daily lives. Filipinos, Africans, and of course, Spaniards and indigenous mingled in a near-perfect rainbow of melanin, speaking more languages than anyone even bothered to count. It's tempting to imagine that a handful of dudes from 1820s Texas, which had 1/278th the wealth of Mexico City, and counted maybe 4,000 Tejanos and maybe 40,000 Indians as its total population, it's tempting to imagine that these dudes would have been overwhelmed by the great metropolis. It's tempting to imagine that they were even awed by it. But there's nothing in the records of José Francisco Ruiz's only ever trip to Mexico City to suggest that it left any kind of impression on these free men of the plains. Ruiz was joined in Mexico by at least two Lipan Apache captains. Huelgas de Castro and Yolca Pocarropa represented a significant portion of the peoples that the Spanish grouped together as Lipan Apaches. Huelgas and Pocarropa represented the two particular groups of Lipanes that had most thoroughly integrated their lifeways with Tejanos. After some convincing by Ruiz in April of 1822, they had agreed to make the almost 1,000-mile journey to Mexico City alongside their on-again, off-again rivals for the Texas Plains, the Comanches, in order to make peace with the newly proclaimed Mexican Empire. After 2 months of waiting for their Comanche frenemies, the Lipanes decided to go on without them. By doing so, they may have made it to Mexico City in time to witness Agustin Iturbide's coronation as Emperor Agustin of the Empire of Mexico. The ceremony, on July 21, 1822, deliberately invoked the dual Old and New World legacies to which the new emperor was making claim at his coronation in the Metropolitan Cathedral, built, in fact, with and on the stones of the old Aztec Templo Mayor. Despite the pageantry, I can find no record of Ruiz or Huelgas or Pocarropa ever mentioning it ever again. Nor did the Comanche captains, at least two of which we can name with some certainty, Huonique and Parrua Quevitzi, who missed the coronation but were still received personally by Emperor Agustin in December 1822 at the signing of their Great Peace Treaty. By then, however, Emperor Agustin's grip on power was already slipping. Proof of how unintimidated the Comanche captains were by the grandeur of Agustin's power was their offer for the Comanche nation to put down the growing insurgency that would eventually topple him. Huonique and Parrua Quevitzi were confident that they could do it with 4,000 Comanches. It's a fascinating alternative history to imagine 4,000 Comanche warriors quashing a young general named Antonio López de Santa Anna's first attempted coup d'etat back in 1822-23. But it never came to be. Maybe the reason that the Lipanes and Comanches were so underwhelmed by the majesty of Mexico City was because the events that had brought these two archenemies there together were even more improbable. The fact that they were leaving their families and peoples behind in the wilderness of Texas to travel straight through the former viceroyalty that had waged pretty much unremitting war on one or the other of them for the last 200 years was unprecedented. That they were leaving their people behind at home and vulnerable and unguarded to the attacks of the very rival Lipan and Comanche captains respectively that were riding alongside them was unimaginable. It was all an incredible act of faith, underwritten almost entirely by their mutual trust in José Francisco Ruiz. After the Battle of Medina in 1813 and from his exile in Louisiana, Ruiz had lived in more or less constant contact with Texas Indians. More accurately, he seems to have lived almost entirely with them. Ruiz had grown up with a Lipan godbrother, I guess you'd call him, and he'd developed particularly close relationships with the Comanches. He seems to have had a Comanche wife at some point. He spoke the language fluently and became particularly close with a Comanche captain named Parrua Quevitzi. It's unclear to what extent Ruiz encouraged them to keep attacking his former Spanish royalist opponents, or whether Ruiz simply helped incentivize the activity by buying the livestock and other goods that they took. But the decided impression of Spanish authorities was that for the decade following the Battle of Medina, Ruiz was waging a proxy war on them through his Lipan and Comanche allies. In 1816, the two tribes even negotiated a truce in order to focus their joint raiding activities on their shared Spanish enemy more effectively, a truce that Ruiz was intimately aware of, if not intimately involved in structuring. The 1816 truce made the two tribes' raiding exponentially more devastating, leading the Texas governor to write in 1818 that, quote, "not a single day passes without their making some depredation or attack," end quote. At one point, he would propose abandoning the province. This is why José Francisco Ruiz was the last major leader of the Texas Revolt in 1813 to be offered a pardon. Even his nephew and brother-in-law, José Antonio Navarro and Juan Martín de Veramendi, had been pardoned the previous year. But so prominent was José Francisco's role as second-in-command of the Tejanos at the Battle of Medina, and so much of a thorn in the side of Spanish rule of Texas after the battle had he been, that his pardon came with two conditions. One, he must broker a peace with the Lipanes and a peace with the Comanches, and two, he must make them come to Mexico City to sign it. No Spanish, Mexican, Texan, or American had ever or would ever again accomplish anything like this. It would take Ruiz almost a year and would see him travel from Louisiana to New Mexico to Coahuila and eventually Mexico City. He would call and attend councils with literally thousands of Native Americans. And somehow, he was able to convince each tribe, in their own way and in their own language, that Mexico would be different than Spain, was different than Spain. Actually, we know the words that he used with the Comanches, at least. He used Comanche idiom, claiming, quote, "we must all live with the same quietness and safety as the birds of beautiful plumage that fly through the air, bringing joy to the countryside, and we must put an end to the birds of prey that disturb them," end quote. Maybe, after so many years of war, this message of peace resonated. The promises of annual tribute payments and the unique recognition of the Lipanes and Comanches as sovereign nations within the Mexican Empire surely helped as well. But did Ruiz really believe what he was selling to the Indios Barbaros of the Texas Plains? That things could be different now that men born on this continent, Americans like them, were in charge? He must have doubted it at some level, especially as he observed that many of the men running the new Mexican Empire, hardly founded on the Republican principles that Ruiz and so many Tejanos had died for, that so many of these new Mexican officers had just a few years been ardent Spanish royalists. Indeed, it had been the butcher General Arredondo himself, victor of the Battle of Medina, and now a general of the Mexican Empire rather than the Spanish one, who had made Ruiz his pardon offer. Of course, Ruiz too had been a royalist at one point, so maybe people could change. When Ruiz returned from Mexico City to San Antonio in April of 1823, after his 10-year-long exile, he was given a hero's welcome. Even old royalist enemies appreciated the magnitude of what Ruiz had accomplished in bringing an unprecedented peace to the Texas Indian frontier. And yet, those old royalists still held tightly to the reins of power. And though Ruiz was reinstated into the army by the terms of his pardon, these ex-royalist officers would be slow to trust, much less forgive, one of the most prominent, gun-running rebels of a frontier they had only ever known as a source of trouble and violence.
Ruiz arrives in the neutral strip along with other Tejano participants. They're initially set up a camp in the neutral strip at a place called Santa Barbara Rio Hondo, which was Ruiz's brother's ranch. Several men then joined Jackson at the Battle of New Orleans, and then they kind of went that route. Others stayed as subsistence farmers, and Ruiz and some of his other cohorts, especially those that ultimately weren't pardoned, became smugglers and began an alliance with the Comanche to smuggle arms and goods onto the frontier.
And even from exile, Ruiz and his Tejano refugees found a way to keep fighting.
There gets to be a point where the governor of Texas recommends that they just abandon Texas. Says, you know, every mule, every cow, everything's been stolen. It's during that time that, you know, Ruiz gains his acceptance by the Comanche. He gets his deep-rooted understanding of their culture and their military traditions, which kind of aids him later on in his service to Texas as a Indian agent and a kind of a ambassador to the Comanche.
Ruiz would spend the decade ranging from Louisiana to Arkansas to Colorado to New Mexico and Coahuila and Tamaulipas, everywhere but home. Luckily for Ruiz, Texas still remained a very solidly Indian domain. Spanish control barely extended outside the cities of San Antonio and Goliad and Nacogdoches. There were maybe 50,000 Indians still living in Texas, as compared to just a couple thousand Tejanos, especially after the massacres at Medina. But the price of Ruiz's pardon in 1822 was to make peace with the two most powerful tribes, the Lipanes and the Comanches. He succeeded, but his new country didn't follow through on the treaties, a first cause for Ruiz's disaffection with his new government, if he needed one.
Unfortunately, it didn't last. The treaties ratified, Ruiz is appointed the commissioner to oversee the treaty, and soon thereafter, Mexico has a uprising, and the emperor is displaced with the republic, and the new Congress of the Republic doesn't want to ratify or doesn't want to adhere to the treaty because it was enacted with the empire and the old emperor, and so the funding to continue on with the treaty is removed, and it ultimately falls apart.
There would be later treaties with the tribes of Texas in the 1850s, where multiple tribes would sit together and agree to terms of peace. But that was at a time when settlers outnumbered native Texans 2 or 3 to 1. Ruiz had no such demographic advantage behind him. He had only his relationships and deep understanding of native Texas. I asked Art what he thought Ruiz's secret was to being able to bring so many different peoples to the council fire.
I think Ruiz's ability to ingratiate himself with different kinds of people, especially indigenous people, one, I think, comes from a natural talent at diplomacy. But two, I think it comes from his ability to see them as equals. And I think Ruiz, through one, his upbringing, having close relationships with indigenous peoples. We know there were, for example, Apache children in his household, in part out of necessity. You know, he's out on the frontier. He can't deal with any of the European powers because he's got a price on his head. I think part of this is also close personal relationships, just like this relation, his compadre relationship with Perez, you might want to call it compadre, but his deep-rooted relationship with the Tenawa chiefs allow him to call on them in his times of need and to transcend these political and cultural differences. Once you've crossed, let's say, the Spaniard and indigenous divide, then it's easy to cross the Tejano-Anglo divide or whatever it may be.
Even Ruiz's resentful superiors in the army couldn't ignore his superpower with the Texas Indians. And eventually, they would need to ask for his help once again. For the first 5 years of Mexican independence, Ruiz's superiors in the Mexican army, most of them ex-royalists, were able to effectively ignore Ruiz. Until, once again, world events so destabilized the Texas frontier that they had no choice but to turn to the one man who seemed willing and able to confront them. I'm talking about the demographic wave that was about to sweep over the Sabine River, first in the form of nearly 10,000 Indians fleeing the removal policies of the United States, and then tens of thousands of more Anglo-Americans following King Cotton West. On the next episode, The Man for Texas. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Art Martinez de Vara for joining us on this episode, and go check out his book about José Francisco Ruiz called Tejano Patriot. You should also go buy the audiobook, read by me, under the same name, Tejano Patriot, and available wherever you buy your audiobooks. For more information about Art and his projects, go check out artmartinezdevara.com. And for more information on my projects and past podcasts, you can go to brandonseal.com.